Good Friday afternoon to you. I'm Andy Klein with this edition of A Juno Afternoon. We're going to be talking today to the host of Fireside Lecture Series happening at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Today it's going to be about the wreck of the Russian-American company vessel Neva. And the guest is going to be Dave McMahon, and he's here with us to talk about that a little bit. Skip Scheel will be here to talk about a preview of his presentation about Israel and Palestine. And we'll talk with Alan Akiyama about Monday's pancake breakfast fundraiser for Meals on Wheels. Also, poet Jesse Parent will be here to highlight his Saturday performance. That's all happening, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, a lot more coming up on this edition of Juno Afternoon. First, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A Canadian First Nation chief says tribes create self-sufficiency through economic development and not with federal government dollars. Chief Clarence Louis says the biggest employer on the reservation should be the tribal business arm. The outspoken chief of the Osoyoos Band of Indians in British Columbia voiced his belief that people should get off welfare and find a job.
Wherever I've been in Indian country, if that tribe has leadership, that has a business focus, that wants to start earning their own money and creating their own jobs, that's the economic horse that's going to pull the social cart.
Louis says his First Nation owns a number of businesses, including golf courses, resorts, and a winery. He added that his community has more jobs than members. Louis delivered his comments in a blunt speech this week to Indigenous and business leaders gathered in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Bureau of Indian Affairs announced that Black Hills land, considered sacred to the Lakota, is on track to being placed into federal trust status. A group of tribes purchased a 2,400-acre site in 2012 after the property's owner announced it would be sold at public auction. Jim Kent has the story.
Peshla, or the heart of all that is, sits at the center of the Black Hills. For some Lakota, it's the most sacred location within a 5,000-square-mile geographical area. So when the Reynolds family announced in August 2012 that the land would be sold, the Rosebud, Crow Creek, Standing Rock, and Shakopee Midwakaden Sioux tribes raised $9 million to purchase the property. Then the tribes petitioned the Secretary of the Interior to place the land into federal trust status in order to regain its designation as a sacred site. Ann Wilson Frederick is director of the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Land Enterprise.
The tribes get to have their say-so over it, what they're going to do with it, which means it's going to go mostly all for cultural, religious purposes.
Rosebud Sioux Tribe Historic Preservation Officer Russell Eagle Bear adds that it's really a case of buying what you already own.
Under treaty, it was this land was given to us, and they took it away from us in 1874. So we're purchasing something that was given to us already.
Notwithstanding, says Eagle Bear, the tribes are moving forward culturally.
This summer we're going to do a journey there and do another ceremony for the summer solstice.
Eagle Bear says returning to Peshla for that ceremony reignites a tradition that took place for countless generations. He says this time Lakota youth will take part once again. I'm Jim Kent.
Most journalists in the U.S. work to protect press freedoms. But the issue is more complex in Indian country. Allison Herrera tells us about the struggles at one Oklahoma media outlet that only recently signed a Freedom of the Press Act.
Last fall, while covering a tribal council meeting, Muskogee media editor Sterling Cosper heard rumblings about a member allegedly getting bumped up the federally mandated housing wait list. If true, it would be highly illegal. But Cosper took a pause. He and his staff weren't sure if they should pursue the story. The ink was still drying on a bill granting them free press protections, and they were nervous they could lose their jobs if tribal officials didn't like what they read or saw.
I think it's a positive thing to police ourselves, and that shows that basically we are self-determinant and we're interested in handling our own affairs our way.
They ultimately decided to run the housing story. It made it to the front page of the newspaper and aired on Native News Today. But it caused a huge amount of stress among staff and reporters who felt their livelihoods might be in danger.
That's a challenge that Native journalists have that, you know, mainstream media really doesn't face.
That's Rebecca Lansbury, the interim executive director of the Native American Journalists Association. She explained that many publications are funded through the tribal government, which may create a conflict of interest for reporters. Back at Muskogee Media, Sterling Cosper and colleagues are energized by their new press protections. I'm Allison Herrera.
Independent producer Allison Herrera is working on a 9-month reporting project called Invisible Nations, exploring Native communities in Oklahoma. For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Join Sitka Fine Arts Camp and Sitka Sound Science Center this July for 2 weeks of exploration, inquiry, and adventure. Sitka Arts and Science Festival is a new summer program for adults that bring together the arts and sciences through intensive workshops, guided excursions, and accommodations on Sitka Fine Arts Camp's historic campus. These two sessions run from July 16th until the 23rd and July 23rd until the 30th. You can find more information at sitkafestival.org or 907-747-3085.
And welcome back to the KTO studios, where I've been joined by Dave McMahon and also by Bob Sam. They're both taking part in a fireside lecture series that's happening tonight. It's going to be at 6:30 and 8 o'clock, and it's all about the wreck of the Russian-American company vessel, the Neva. So thanks to both of you for coming in. And Dave, if you can just tell us a little bit of the historic kind of, the start of the story, the historic facts behind the story.
Well, basically, the Neva was probably one of the best-known ships to apply to Alaska's waters. It was a British commercial ship initially, and then after 1803, it was in the service of the Russian-American Company. But it was pretty well-known for a number of things. It participated in the first round-the-world voyages, first Russian round-the-world voyages, along with a sister ship, the Nadezhda. It was the first Russian ship to call in Australia, the first Russian ship to call in Hawaii, what's now Hawaii. But in Alaska, and in southeast Alaska in particular, is probably best known for its role in the Battle of Sitka between the Russians and the Kiksati clan of the Tlingit.
And so this is an interesting approach to your lecture series where you have yourself, but also Bob, you're with the Tribal Council in Sitka. And so to get the two perspectives, the two historical perspectives, is an interesting approach.
Yes, having two perspectives of this ship was very interesting for me. The Neva was involved with the battle with the Tlingits in Sitka, and I became involved, very concerned about the integrity of the ship. It had some human remains, and so I was concerned about that. So I went out to the site and got very interested in what they were doing out there.
And so what was happening out there? Are they recovering the wreck, or what was going on?
Let me talk about that
sure.
A little bit. The Neva was, it wrecked in January 1813, and for the last 200 years, folks have been looking for it. And like most Alaska shipwrecks, stories and legends spring up about all the treasures on board and all that sort of stuff. And like others, I became interested in it. So we went out and didn't find evidence of the wreck itself, although we have a pretty good idea where it is. We did find evidence that we believe relates to the survivor camp. So that's where we've been working.
Mm-hmm.
We got a National Science Foundation grant to put an international team on the site, Russians, Americans, and Canadians, to try to collect information.
Are the circumstances of the wreck itself known?
Yes. The official records have been lost, at least they've not been located, but there are a number of survivor accounts that were published and translated after the fact, and they're for the most part in agreement, so we have some details of the wreck itself.
And what's sort of been pieced together that actually happened that caused the wreck?
Well, just when it left Siberia in August of 1812, it just had one problem after another, and Bob maybe can talk about some of that. But basically, it was a cursed ship. The skipper died before they even left port, so they had to find a new skipper to replace the one that drowned. And then it just got hammered by winds and storms all the way down along the Aleutian chain. They weren't able to get fresh water. Something like 15 died at sea. And they finally limped into Prince William Sound and had to make the call whether to try for Sitka or to winter in the Sound. And the decision was made to try for Sitka. And they almost made it. But practically within sight of the Sound, the ship wrecked. We're not sure why, but it ended up going the opposite direction from what was intended. And next thing you know, rocks were under the bow, and the person who was supposed to have secured the anchor line hadn't secured it to the windlass, so it spun out, went on the rocks. There were something like 32 deceased as a result of the wreck, and two died on shore, and there were 26 survivors.
Mm. And Bob, you've got a little bit of perspective on that part of the story as well?
The ship, the Neva, was a very much a cursed ship. The warfare in this part of the world during that time was very different. The culture, the Tlingit culture, was very strong and very active. And so the sinking of the ship was, there were clans and spiritual type people cursed the ship, essentially, and it was doomed before it was even left Siberia. And when it arrived on the outside of Sitka, the coast out there is very, lots of natural phenomena occurs out there, lots of weather and rocks, and there are some sites out there that are culturally sensitive as well, so it's a very powerful place, so I feel that this place, the ship was essentially brought down. Cursed.
Wow. And you were saying tell me about you were saying there's human remains potentially on board still in among the wreckage of the ship. What are some of the concerns there?
Well, the concerns for me, was the disposition of the remains, what will happen to them. But when I went out there, I saw the quality of people that are working on that site, so I wasn't worried at all after I saw who was working there.
Oh, okay.
Some very professional people.
Oh, great. Well, so tell me a little bit about what the lecture is going to look like if people go tonight.
Well, we're going to walk through some of the history and some of the new historical facts that we uncovered in archives in Russia and in London. And then we'll talk a bit about the archaeology and what we found so far, and try to put the story together. And it is an interesting story. And what I always say is that we come here to bury Caesar, not to praise him. So we're just interested in separating the lore of the sea from scientific outcomes.
Yeah. Right. Well, it sounds fascinating. Again, it's all about the wreck of the Russian-American company vessel, the Neva, and it's with Dave McMahon and Bob Sam. They'll be at the Glacier Visitor Center tonight at 6:30, and then again at 8 o'clock, so you have two opportunities to see the lecture. And Dave and Bob, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know all about the Neva, and have a great lecture tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be a part of the important conversation inspired by Wrestling Jerusalem by attending a free reading of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Disgraced, at 7 p.m. on Monday, March 28th, at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall. A cast of Perseverance Theater actors will deliver this bold exploration of race and identity and what it means to be a Muslim in America's multi-religious society. This one-time event is sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast and the community groups that brought you Wrestling Jerusalem.
And welcome back to the K2 Studios. Andy Klein with you, and joining me now is Bob Schroeder from JWAC, from the Juvenile World Affairs Council, and also Skip Scheel, who's here as a photographer and is the person giving a couple of different presentations. So thanks to both of you for coming in. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Andy. Mm-hmm.
So tell me, Skip, a little bit about, you've got two different talks. One, let's just start with the one that's happening first. The first one's going to be Monday, March 28th. It's at 5 p.m. It's here at the KTO Studios at the 360 North Studios. And it's about timeline, Palestine, and Israel. So tell me a little bit about that talk.
It's an illustrated timeline of the history going back to the first International Zionist Conference in the late 1890s. And the show has special emphasis on the current period, which means about the last 30 years. So I've been working on photographing the region for the past 13 years, since 2003. I've been there 9 times, 6 times to Gaza. So I've made a lot of photographs. And I put them, along with photographs that I found from other sources, into a show that hopefully helps people understand the situation there.
Yeah, so that it's such a multifaceted and complex situation. So how do you bring clarity to it?
Well, invariably, an artist presents from his or her point of view. So I don't claim that this would represent everybody. It represents my understanding of the situation, but I try to show elements from the two main narratives, which would be the Israeli and the Palestinian. So, for example, in 1948, the State of Israel was formed. In 1948, the catastrophe for the Palestinians began. In Arabic, that word is Nakba. And so I put them side by side without trying to stress or value one more than the other.
And that is really the crux of the position. You have these two societies that have just this fundamental difference. And it's been playing itself out and has been sort of a crisis spot ever since. So the second one that you talk about, and that's happening on Sunday, April 3rd, Gaza's Israeli neighbors. So what's the different take on that one?
Well, that's a movie with a lot of stills in it, but interviews primarily with people in a group called Other Voice. They're Israeli Jews who live within a mile of Gaza, so they are among the most heavily attacked. And yet, this particular group calls for negotiations, not war, talks, not tanks. And I try to explore who they are, why they do what they do, and perhaps project into the future as a possible solution. That is negotiation rather than rockets and other military means.
And this is a free showing of this film. It's happening at Northern Light United Church in Juneau, and that's happening Sunday at 7 p.m. That's April 3rd. And then the slideshow and the talk is happening Monday, March 28th. That's at 5 p.m. here at the KTOO Studios. And is that then, Bob, going to be part of a filmed – is that going to be –
Yeah, Andy, that's part of a regular Juneau World Affairs Council program, and what we've been doing with all our speakers now is filming those for 360 North, and then at some time in the future they may be broadcast, or they're also, I believe, accessible online. You're the tech guy, you can tell
me.
No,
that's absolutely right. I just didn't know if it was set up to be.
Yeah, well, World Affairs Council has been doing this for a while because we get great speakers into town, and then that's fine for Juneau, but of course somebody's not going to be able to travel all over our vast state. So this is a way of getting the word out there.
Yeah, it's exciting to think about that as something that can be captured as a program that can be learned from continually. So of the two different, tell me about the perspective of the two different kind of stories here. Why did you why do you have these two different ways of approaching this area? One's a film. It seems like that, boy, that'd be enough to have a film and to go and promote that and to work on that. But you also have put together this other project. What were you trying to achieve out of the out of having two of these projects happening?
I have more than two.
Okay,
Andy.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Since I've been working on it so long, and I photograph a lot, I have a strong desire to show my photos. And for me, to show my photos effectively, I have to put them into some kind of structure, into a narrative. So generally it's slideshows, but it's also movies and print exhibits. And other themes are water. I have three shows about the Jordan River and hydropolitics generally. I also look into nonviolent resistance to the occupation, the role of youth. Since I've been in Gaza so much, I have a program about that. And I think there's probably a unified perspective if somebody looked at the different shows. Some say that I lean toward the Palestinians, but I am looking for peace, justice, reconciliation, and security for all the people that are there. And at the moment, in my view, the Palestinians are treated unjustly. And so that probably is part of my perspective and would come through each one of my presentations.
Do you thinking about the timeline of Palestine and Israel, you know, where are we on the crisis level along that timeline, or where are we along, you know, reaching a conclusion, reaching a satisfactory reconciliation? Is it one of the worst times right now? Is it one of the medium times? Has it been worse than this? Has it been better than this?
It's probably one of the worst times. So Gaza has been attacked ferociously over the past 8 years. Most recently, 2014, a lot of people began their attention to the region when they saw what was happening in the summer of 2014. The Israelis, this includes all the politicians, but also the people, elected the most right-wing government in its history. It was a year ago when I was there, it happened with Netanyahu. The Congress in our country is leaning very solidly, as it has been, but even more so, I think, now, to support the Israelis. And to get a taste of that, just look at the presidential candidates, most recently Trump and Clinton, who appeared before AIPAC. But I hesitate to say that means the chances for resolution are at their worst, because surprises happen. We look at South Africa, Ireland, the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Union. Each one of those changed greatly, not necessarily in a positive way, without people understanding this was about to happen. And when things get bad, they can also get good. To quote Theodore Redke, in a dark time, the eye begins to see.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of inspiring words, because it does seem like it's you know, a continual morass. It seems like it's something that, you know, you can look at that situation and go, well, there's just never going to ever be a resolution to that. But it seems like, as you say, often these things change without us thinking that they're going to change, you know, and in those times they can. So it's a fascinating couple of discussions to have. One, of course, is the film. It's happening April 3rd. That's Sunday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. And that's going to be out at Northern Light Church here in the Flats in Juneau. That's a free admission to that. And then the slideshow and talk is happening Monday, March 28th at 5 p.m. right here at the KTO studios at 360 Egan Drive. And that's Timeline, Palestine, and Israel, and both by Skip Scheel and brought to you by the Juneau World Affairs Council. Skip, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about what you're going to be speaking about and what your film's about. And Bob, thanks for bringing Skip in.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for driving him around town.
Okay.
All right, thanks so much. Right now, here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 25th of March, 2016. It's the birthday of the writer who said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd." She said, "Where you come from is gone. Where you thought you were going to never was there. And where you are is no good unless you can get away from it." She didn't want a biography written about her because, she said, lives spent between the house and the chicken yard do not make exciting copy. Flannery O'Connor, born in Savannah, 1925. When she was 5 years old, she trained a chicken to walk backward, and a newsreel company came to her house to make a film about it, which was shown all over the country. She said, "I was just there to assist the chicken, but it was the high point in my life. Everything since has been anticlimax." Spent much of her life on the family farm in Milledgeville, Georgia, raising various birds, writing novels and short stories, Wise Blood, The Violent Bear It Away, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, and Everything That Rises Must Converge. This last book of short stories, published after her death in 1964 at the age of 39 from complications of lupus. Flannery O'Connor, who said, "Everywhere I go, I'm asked if I think the university stifles writers. My opinion is that they don't stifle enough of them." It's the birthday of the writer who said, "A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle." That was Gloria Steinem, born in Toledo, Ohio, 1934. Her father, an entrepreneur, traveled all over the country in a trailer looking for new business ventures. Steinem said he was always going to make a movie or cut a record or start a new hotel or come up with a new orange drink. She traveled around with him, never went to school until her parents separated, and she moved in with her mother, who suffered a mental breakdown. Steinem said, "My mother was an invalid who lay in bed with eyes closed and lips moving in occasional response to voices only she could hear. A woman to whom I brought an endless stream of toast and coffee, bologna sandwiches, and dime pies." Gloria Steinem, who had poor grades in school, but she managed to get into Smith, based entirely on her entrance exams. After college, went to work as a journalist. She made her name with a piece called "I Was a Playboy Bunny" in 1963, about working undercover at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Club in Midtown Manhattan. Went on to found Ms. Magazine in 1972. Gloria Steinem, who said, "Writing is the only thing that when I do it, I don't feel I should be doing something else." Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, "Neither Here Nor There." An airport is nowhere, which is not something generally noticed, yet some unnamed person in the past deliberately planned it, and you have spent time there again for something you have done which you do not entirely remember, like the souls in purgatory. You sit there in the smell of what passes for food, breathing what is called air, while the timepieces measure their agreement. You believe in it while you are there, because you are there. Sometimes you may even feel happy to be that far on your way to somewhere. A poem by W.S. Merwin, "Neither Here Nor There," from "The Moon Before Morning," published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by LegalZoom, supporting small businesses with formations, corporate filings, and independent contract and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Join us for 360 North's The Artist with Ernestine Hayes. Through readings, conversation, and video footage, we'll explore Hayes' writing, her influences, and more.
That growing, uncovered spirit holds within it all the life, all the promise, all the seeds of all our futures.
The one-hour program begins at 7 p.m. on Friday, March 25th at 360 in the K2 building. Admission is free.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, where it is supposed to be scattered rain showers happening for the rest of today, and then becoming rain likely tonight, rain tomorrow, rain likely into Saturday night, and then mostly cloudy skies on Sunday is in the forecast. Well, Alan Akiyama, and Eileen Wagner have joined me to talk about fun stuff: a pancake breakfast, the Great Meal on Wheels program, which Eileen is the coordinator of. But Alan, let's talk about pancakes and breakfast and how to help the folks at the senior center here first.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah,
thanks
sure.
for having us on the program today. Yes, every Sewers Day and Alaska Day, the Juneau Senior Center puts on a pancake breakfast fundraiser. So for Sewers Day next Monday, March 28th, we're going to have a pancake breakfast served at the Juneau Senior Center, which is located at 12th and Egan Drive. Hours are 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Tickets are $13 in advance for adults, $15 at the door. For children 7 to 12, at $7, and $6 are free. We're going to have a wonderful breakfast, good way to start the day. Pancakes, scrambled eggs, some different types of choices for meats, juice, coffee, tea, some fresh fruit. And we're also going to have some music from Dale Wygant and his group. So come on down.
And this all goes directly for the Meals on Wheels program?
This goes to the Senior Nutritionist Program, of which Meals on Wheels is a part of. So the Senior Nutritionist Program here in Juneau provides a hot meal every weekday, Monday through Friday, at the Juneau Senior Center from approximately 11:45 to 12:30. It also provides hot meals every Tuesday and Thursday at the Douglas United Methodist Church. And there are free well donation for the meal, so we ask that those under 60 pay $10, 60 and above pay $5. And there's no age limit. You don't have to be a senior to come to these meals. I eat there on occasion. So you can come on down if you'd like a break from cooking lunch and just bring yourself or family or friends.
All right, cool. And Eileen, as the coordinator of Meals on Wheels, what all goes into that, coordinating Meals on Wheels? It seems like there must be a lot of activity happening.
Well, we have between 70 and 75 people who receive Meals on Wheels, and we have between 30 and 40 volunteers. Each of the volunteers delivers once a week, and then we have some people who are substitutes, and we have different routes around town where they deliver. So, it's kind of attention to detail is the name of the game. It's interesting because it's the people that you don't see out and about around town. These are homebound people, mostly senior citizens, who are unable to leave their homes without assistance. And so we're able to give them a meal 5 days a week. That's about it. It's a very meaningful program, I think.
It's a real vital kind of life link for a number
of
people.
It is, and it
yeah.
provides not only food, but also a safety check for these people and a little bit of social contact. In some cases, we're the only person, or the driver is the only person that the person sees every day. So it's important.
Do those deliveries happen every day, or they happen a couple times a week, or are they happening every day with the 70 people?
Well, most of the people receive 5 days a week. There are a few people that only receive 2 or 3 days a week because they choose to, so that can happen too. But I'm always looking for more volunteers, and people usually start as a substitute if they're a volunteer driver, and I'll go with them and show them the route and introduce them to the people. And right now I especially need more drivers in the valley. So if anyone out there is in the valley and having a little time on their hands, that'd be great.
What kind of
you.
Time commitment does it take typically?
It's just about an hour a week. So it's not much at all. The people do have to go through a background check, and they have to have a car and a driver's license, of course. And we have some people who do it as a couple, and they have entirely too much fun together, I think. We have some people who do it with a younger person in the car who can't drive, who helps them deliver the meal. So people have different ways
yeah,
of doing it.
Yeah, sure. Alan, you've been in here before talking about the senior center. Why are you so committed to the senior center? What is it that's why has that become so important to you?
Well, although I'm not a senior yet, I think that maybe one day I may be using these services. I consider paying it forward.
Okay.
Right now, if you want to contact Eileen to ask her about helping out, you can contact her 463-6179. And I've been on the Juno Senior Center Advisory Council for a number of years now, and it's a great group of people. If you're interested in joining, we have monthly meetings every second Friday of the week at 1 p.m. at the Juno Senior Center. Usually most of us get together that day and have a meal there, and then we have the meeting. We have an excellent president, and he doesn't let our meetings run longer than an hour. So we're usually in and out by 2 p.m.
Very good. Yeah, it's always appreciated when the chair or president keeps those meetings tight, right? That's always a good thing.
That's correct.
We've all been in the never-ending committee meetings before, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, is there volunteer opportunities that maybe if Meals on Wheels isn't the one that people are interested in, are there other volunteer opportunities happening at the Senior Center?
Yes. If you'd like, you can always volunteer to help at the Noonday Meals. We're always looking for people to help serve and clean up afterwards. And we're always looking for help the day of our breakfast fundraisers also to help out in the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to talk to anyone before. You can just show up and say, hey, I'd like to help out today.
Yeah,
I'll put you to work.
Cool. And I mean, are there ways that people can get signed up for Meals on Wheels or get their family members signed up? Or how does that happen?
Well, it happens either directly. Yeah, they could call me, 463-6179. Or many of the people come through either the hospital or social workers or caregivers who realize that the people need a little extra help. So it happens in those ways. But I also wanted to add to something Alan said about the fundraising. This spring, we've had a wonderful opportunity with the Mudrooms storytelling event. And Mudrooms has chosen Meals on Wheels to receive the proceeds from the 4 months of their spring storytelling series. So that's been a wonderful event for us because it's lots of fun. It's a new group of people for us to find out about our program, and we've been making a little extra money.
That's great. Yeah. So, go listen to amazing stories being told and do a little bit for Meals on Wheels at the same time. That's a cool thing to think about. Yeah. Well, thanks so much to both of you for coming in. Once again, the thing that's happening on Monday, we want to run through it one more time for us, Alan?
Thanks, Andy.
Sure.
Again, it's Sewers Day this coming Monday, March 28th, a breakfast Pancake fundraiser will be at the Juno Senior Center, 12th and Egan Drive. Hours are 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Tickets are $13 in advance, $15 at the door. Children 7 to 12, $7, 6 and under are free. So come on down, bring a hearty appetite, and help out the Senior Interest Program.
And you were also mentioning that on Saturday, April 7th, there's going to be a bazaar or some sort of a garage sale kind of thing? Or?
The Juno Senior Center is organizing a bazaar for Saturday, May 7th at the Juno Senior Center. And if anyone's interested in selling arts and crafts, baked goods, whatever, they can contact Carol Comoli at the Senior Center, 463-6175. Small tables are $25, large tables are $50, and again, all the money that we raise goes to the Senior Nutritionist Program here in Juno.
And that's the same thing the money goes to for Monday's Pancake Breakfast Fundraiser, of which Meals on Wheels is a part. Eileen Wagner, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
And Alan Akiyama, thank you once again for coming in, and have a great pancake feed on Monday.
Thank you, Andy.
All right.
This is Bird Dog. In the East and Midwest, purple martins nest almost to a pair only in birdhouses provided by humans. They depend on people to a huge extent and thrive close by their homes. People, in turn, tend to get
pretty passionate about these little birds. This bond goes back a long way. European settlers in the 1600s found that Native American tribes like the Choctaw and Chickasaw in the southeast routinely hung up hollow gourds for purple martins to nest in. Anthropologist Frank Speck argued that these tribes, which planted extensive gardens, learned to attract nesting martins as a way of reducing insect pests. And because martins fiercely guard their nest areas, they would drive away crows and blackbirds at planting time. Early European settlers soon took up the practice too, hanging gourds and building the first multi-cavity birdhouses for martins. By the time of John James Audubon's travels in the 1830s, martin houses adorned many a country inn. Today, while purple martins west of the Rockies will happily nest in an old woodpecker hole or similar space, purple martins east of the Rockies rarely nest in natural cavities. Living alongside humans has resulted in a nearly complete behavioral shift in the habits of this wild species. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Support comes from Treadwell Ice Arena, offering an adult hockey clinic March 26th from 4 until 5 p.m. and March 27th from 1:30 until 2:30 p.m. No experience is necessary and all abilities are welcome. Those interested are encouraged to sign up early. Helmets, breezers, elbow pads, gloves, shin guards, sticks, and jerseys are all available and offered on a first-come, first-served basis. More information at 586-0410.
Welcome back to the Friday edition of Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and Eric Caldwell from As If, from the Alaska State Improv Festival, and also Jesse Parent has come in. Jesse, welcome to town.
Thanks thank you very much for coming in. I really am enjoying myself quite a bit.
Yeah, Eric, you guys have brought Jesse in as a speaker and a slam poetry artist and all kinds of other stuff too, right?
So let's, yes.
Tell me what attracted you to bringing Jesse in here.
Well, I knew Jesse actually before he was a slam poet, right? Mm. When he was first getting into the slam poetry scene. He has been a veteran of over 40 improv festivals and was involved with the Chicago Improv Festival as well as an associate fellow.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. So you came to it from that perspective.
Yeah. So I come at Poetry Slam from a very theatrical angle. So I view it as monologue. And Poetry Slam is a very big umbrella. So you can come at it from the literary side, from the rant side, or from, like I did, with the literary side. And I really think of it as performance poetry. So if you've got acting skills, you should be able to do pretty well. And in 2010 and 2011, I took second place in the worlds, so I was okay with it.
I was reading that. I was very impressed. Yeah, it's incredible. Where do the worlds, they happen in different places every time? Well, tell me about the scene. What's the scene like at the World Poetry Slam?
Well, it's very competitive. In fact, this last couple weeks ago, they had the Women of the World Poetry Slam. Those 96 competitors from all over. And I like to look at the worlds as sort of how the U.S. looks at the World Series.
Yeah, right.
So,
sure.
So, you know, we want the worlds, but now we have to go to Paris.
Right, right.
So the winner of the individual worlds goes on to go compete in Paris with the African champion, the European champion, Asian champion, et cetera. So I didn't get to do that. My wife likes to joke at me, and she said, you know, this time if you don't – we're not going to Paris. Don't go
right.
home.
Yeah,
don't
right.
come home. Just stay.
Like, yeah, we got to get a Paris trip out of this at least, right?
Right.
That's how you approached it, but how did you get into it? How did you go from being someone who was already successfully doing improv work and was recognized as someone who did improv work, and then kind of why did this art form kind of speak to you?
When you're in remote areas like Juneau or Salt Lake City where you don't have a lot of art and you have to travel and bring that art in, I started to teach a improv class called 4 Weeks of Form where we would either create or explore existing improv forms. And so we started to create this format after I had watched Deaf Poetry on HBO and seen this group called Flowetry that wove music and poetry together. And I figured out, how can I turn that into an improv form? So we workshopped it for a while and then started to tour that. And it was weird going from – I typically tour with a two-man group, and it's really portable because you just have to say, hey, are you going to be there? Yeah, okay,
right.
See you there.
Yeah.
With
easy.
Nine people where you have this larger ensemble, and so we had to be very selective about where we went. But it was a pretty unique forum where we would do improvised slam poetry and then try to treat the whole forum as what can we do with poetry elements like metaphor, like repetition, like chants even – and that really did well, and the Chicago Improv Festival in 2006 said we really wanted to recognize this as a form that we think is innovative and maybe an artistic associate.
That's awesome. Wow, that's really cool. So you really feel like you kind of hit on something right? You
know, like, I mean, what's next, right?
Yeah, right, right.
And at a certain point, you're like, oh, well, I've gotten to this much success. I might as well go to the source and say, how would this look in real slam poetry, and what lessons can I take away that works that I can take and make into patterns that I can put back into improv, because improv is very mathy. It's very much about pattern work.
But that was what I was going to ask next, was sort of the tricks of the trade, if you will, of improv, how you feel like that. Do you feel like it almost gives you a competitive advantage in a way? Like you have this in the back of your head, you know, you have these kind of tools that maybe someone who's just done slam poetry doesn't have access to those.
I think so, because it gives you an idea of how do you vary levels, whether they're physical levels or vocal levels. It also gives you a sense of pattern of there's a great quote from this improv book called Truth and Comedy that Mike Myers gave of the end is in the beginning. And I use that so many times in my writing workshops to say, hey, if you can't figure out how to end a poem, try to look in the first 10 lines. And so you have these three-act structures, all these other things that come from theater, from improv, and so forth that you can use in your writing styles. And I'm going to be teaching a lot of that tomorrow, actually, in a workshop.
Very
of
cool.
How to use improv as a writing tool.
Where's the workshop? What's happening there?
Well, the workshop is going to be at the Hangar Ballroom as well from 2 to 5 p.m. We have a $30 workshop fee, and whoever wants to come down and learn how to use improvisational techniques to build up their writing skills is welcome to come and register at the door.
And also the performing skills, as you are mentioning, that really brings a second level to what you're doing as a slam artist.
Exactly. I like to say performance is punctuation, where you have performance poetry, you have page poetry, which the sonnet, or rather the structures of the stanzas really give you a sense of how to pace this. But if you can, in performance, relay that or relay some other piece of information that just wasn't there on the paper. For example, I have a poem called Hooked Cross, where I struggled with the words and how to get people to understand what this poem was until I found the performance aspect of how do I transform myself into a swastika so that I can say that this is a poem that talks about a swastika communicating to a Christian cross about the perils of being used for some purpose that is not originally – it wasn't originally meant for.
Hmm. Wow. And so the way that you kind of decided to interpret that was to actually physically try to – give an indication or transform into these symbols.
Right. And I also use a lot – I come from a company that does a lot of work with the deaf. And so we provide communication services that I've had to learn sign language. And sign language has all these amazing classifiers and ways of expressing yourself either facially or just in space. And that becomes a great performance tool for just clearly indicating something that – can be transformed without language, or that is a language in itself and just sits on top of another language.
I was at a Bruce Springsteen concert in Minneapolis a couple of weeks ago, and the sign language, there was a sign language interpreter that was signing to a certain section, and I, in the middle of a Springsteen concert, got distracted and was watching her perform.
Right.
Because there was a performance to it, and you realize, oh, well, that's absolutely the way you can convey big ideas in a short amount of time, that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, you've got it exactly right, especially when you're doing – you're interpreting performance and a performance sign.
It's really
just
cool.
It's so captivating. They start doing these really big motions, and it's smooth, and it looks like ocean waves, and all of a sudden you're just drawn right in. You're like, Bruce,
it utterly, utterly was like that, really.
You might be the boss, but this is the CEO of the board.
I missed Born to Run entirely because I was watching. So tell me, Eric, what you hope to kind of learn from this. You're someone who's utterly and consumed with improv quite a bit, but this is a different area that you maybe don't dabble in as much.
Well, certainly not as much, but it is something that Mike and I have dabbled in. We have an improv format called Poetic License, where we are taking words from the audience and we're creating slam poetry out of the words that we've been given, and then creating scenes from these poems that have been recited on the spot. So we do incorporate poetry in some forms of our improv already. And having Jesse up here being such a master of both formats, both genres, being able to bring that together, mash it in, you know, we can't help but learn from that.
Does slam poetry have a life on the written page, too, as far as you're concerned? Or how is that? What's the relationship between the performance and the written page when it comes to slam poetry?
Well, I think Billy Collins, who was the poet laureate of the U.S., said it best. You know, all poetry should be like an eye chart. Everyone should get the E, but if you squint, you ought to be able to get a little bit more. So poetry, when it's slam poetry, it's very much the E is very apparent, because you're being judged after 3 minutes, and someone who has never, ever been to a poetry slam is given a scorecard, and they have to immediately process that. But at the same time, good poets who are performing in slam and writing, their writing has another level that if you look, if you squint, has that much more. And there are some folks who are very accessible and they're just meant to be digested like candy, and it's like it's simple carbohydrates. There is what their poetry really is. But if you really take that poem that's been performed and start to look at it and dissect it and pull it apart, you're like, oh, there's just a whole other meaning. And it's like a good song. Anytime that you hear a song, you'll get something else out of it, depending on your own mood, you hope.
Yeah, right. Do you feel that traditional poetry is there for interpretation in the slam format?
I absolutely.
Does that happen? I don't know if that happens. Maybe it does. Yeah.
There's always a dead poet slam. Okay. They're very popular. There's a, you know, Seuss comes up quite a bit, as does Plath. There's some things, you know, poetry is meant for language, it's meant for meter, and so when you can find that meter and find that flow, that language that the poet meant to put in there, because you know most of these page poets are writing things that are meant to be recited, or at least they have some mental picture that they're trying to bring about, then it's still beautiful, mm-hmm. and you can get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
But with slam, it has become much more, again, accessible, much more about how do you create emotion and really get someone ramped up, or how do you split emotion. I like to use two distinct emotional values in the work that I do. I like to try to make someone laugh and someone cry in the same 3 minutes. And I feel that that's really powerful and can help someone who is in the audience not be bored by just hearing the same thing said at the same level, or even just feeling the same emotional value.
Right. Well, let's make sure we cover everything you're doing here this weekend, because you're doing Sound and Motion tonight out at UAS, is that right?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. So what do you know what time that is? Or I don't have that written here, so
they're having the Poetry Slam sign-ups at 6:30. The slam itself starts at 7, and Jesse's going to be doing a 10 to 15 minute feature in between the first and second rounds.
Awesome. Okay. And then tomorrow night, one night only, happening at the Hangar Ballroom, it's at 8 p.m., and that is the live slam poetry where Jesse's, you're on stage.
Yeah, we're going to be improvising.
Oh,
and
okay.
We're going to be improvising and doing slam poetry.
So are the others going to be working with you as well?
Yeah, Eric.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I'll be there along with Mike Christensen. Mike is a local champion slam poet, and he'll be doing a few of his own poems. We'll be doing some improvised poetry interspersed with scenes, and Jesse will be doing both his written and his improvised poetry.
Very cool. And then the workshop is tomorrow as well.
Right? Yes, from 2 to 5 at the Hangar Ballroom.
And that's a $30 kind of fee for the whole... I mean, that's like a three-hour workshop going on?
Yes. So if you figure it's like minimum wage, I'm getting minimum wage.
Right. And you're gonna have enough left for the 8 p.m. performance, right?
Absolutely.
You seem like a high-energy guy.
I am. I've had 16 ounces of coffee before I came on stage, so this is great.
Yeah.
I'm vibrating right now.
Okay.
We'll be sure to feed him in between.
Yeah, give him a little bit of food. Okay, so it's Jesse Parent once again. Multiple accolades on the world level of slam poetry. Really fun to have you up here. Thanks for making the trip up.
Well, thanks for having me. This is beautiful.
And Sound and Motion happening tonight. 7 p.m. is when the Poetry Slam is happening. You're going to be performing there. Workshop tomorrow during the day at the Hangar Ballroom. And then tomorrow night, 8 p.m. If folks want to find out a little bit more about the workshop or anything, is there a place they can go online, that kind of stuff?
Yes, they can go to asifest.com, and they can also learn more about the Alaska State Improv Festival, which is happening next month from April 28 to May 1st. We have improvisers coming from 13 different cities, over 4 days, and we're expecting to have an incredible time.
All right. That sounds great. Jesse Parent, thanks so much for coming in. Eric Caldwell, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Part of the As If folks. And once again, tomorrow night, one night only, it's happening in the Hangar Ballroom. Tickets are only $10. It's cheap. Man, you got to start charging more for tickets. And but, you know, get in while you can, folks. These prices aren't going to last forever. And it's all happening tomorrow starting at 8 o'clock. Jesse, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's it for a Juno afternoon for today. Once again, tonight, rain. Rain's in the forecast for tomorrow as well, and then mostly cloudy skies on Sunday. Thanks to all my guests for coming in and sharing what's going on this weekend and the coming weeks here in Juno, our busy little town here. That's between poetry slams and the presentation tonight out at the Glacier Visitor Center. Also, the presentations by JWAC happening this coming week. And, the fun Monday pancake breakfast for Seward's Day. It's all happening. Thanks again. Have a great weekend. You don't have to go. You're the poetry man. You're making the
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.